in any other light. That was not his theory, of course. To Freud, it was the idea of incest with mother or sister that makes man regard the sex act as something degrading, which soils and contaminates not only the body. In any event, the degradation of women was taken for granted by Freud and is the key to his theory of femininity. The motive force of woman's personality, in Freud's theory, was her envy of the penis, which causes her to feel as much depreciated in her own eyes as in the eyes of the boy, and later perhaps of the man, and leads in normal femininity to the wish for the penis of her husband, a wish that is never really fulfilled until she possesses a penis through giving birth to a son. In short, she is merely an homme manqué, a man with something missing. As the eminent psychoanalyst Clara Thompson put it, Freud never became free from the Victorian attitude toward women. He accepted as an inevitable part of the fate of being a woman the limitation of outlook and life of the Victorian era, the castration complex and penis envy concepts, two of the most basic ideas in his whole thinking, are postulated on the assumption that women are biologically inferior to men. What did Freud mean by the concept of penis envy? For even those who realize that Freud could not escape his culture do not question that he reported truly what he observed within it. Freud found the phenomenon he called penis envy so unanimous in middle-class women in Vienna in that Victorian time that he based his whole theory of femininity on it, he said in a lecture on the psychology of women. In the boy, the castration complex is formed after he has learned from the sight of the female genitals that the sexual organ which he prizes so highly is not a necessary part of every woman's body. And thenceforward, he comes under the influence of castration anxiety, which supplies the strongest motive force for his further development. The castration complex in the girl, as well, is started by the sight of the genital organs of the other sex. She immediately notices the difference and, it must be admitted, its significance. She feels herself at a great disadvantage and often declares that she would like to have something like that too, and falls a victim to penis envy, which leaves ineradicable traces on her development and character formation, and even in the most favorable instances is not overcome without a great expenditure of mental energy. That the girl recognizes the fact that she lacks a penis does not mean that she accepts its absence lightly. On the contrary, she clings for a long time to the desire to get something like it, and believes in that possibility for an extraordinary number of years. And even at a time when her knowledge of reality has long since led her to abandon the fulfillment of this desire as being quite unattainable, analysis proves that it still persists in the unconscious and retains a considerable charge of energy. The desire, after all, to obtain the penis for which she so much longs may even contribute to the motives that impel a grown-up woman to come to analysis and what she quite reasonably expects to get from analysis, such as the capacity to pursue an intellectual career, can often be recognized as a sublimated modification of this repressed wish. The discovery of her castration is a turning point in the life of the girl, Freud went on to say. She is wounded in her self-love by the unfavorable comparison with the boy, who is so much better equipped. Her mother and all women are depreciated in her own eyes as they are depreciated for the same reason in the eyes of man. This either leads to complete sexual inhibition and neurosis or to a masculinity complex in which she refuses to give up phallic activity. That is, activity such as is usually characteristic of the male, or to normal femininity, in which the girl's own impulses to activity are repressed, and she turns to her father in her wish for the penis. The feminine situation is, however, only established when the wish for the penis is replaced by the wish for a child, the child taking the place of the penis. When she played with dolls, this was not really an expression of her femininity, since this was activity, not passivity. The strongest feminine wish, the desire for a penis, finds real fulfillment only if the child is a little boy who brings a longed-for penis with him. The mother can transfer to her son all the ambition she has had to suppress in herself, and she can hope to get from him the satisfaction of all that has remained to her of her masculinity complex. But her inherent deficiency and the resultant penis envy is so hard to overcome that the woman's superego, her conscience, ideals, are never as completely formed as a man's. Women have but little sense of justice, and this is no doubt connected with the preponderance of envy in their mental life. For the same reason, women's interests in society are weaker than those of men, and their capacity for the sublimation of their instincts is less. Finally, Freud cannot refrain from mentioning an impression which one receives over and over again in analytical work, that not even psychoanalysis can do much for women because of the inherent deficiency of femininity. A man of about 30 seems a youthful and, in a sense, an incompletely developed individual, of whom we expect that he will be able to make good use of the possibilities of development which analysis lays open to him. But a woman of about the same age frequently staggers us by her psychological rigidity and unchangeability. There are no paths open to her for further development. It is as though the whole process had been gone through and remained inaccessible to influence for the future. As though, in fact, the difficult development which leads to femininity had exhausted all the possibilities of the individual, even when we are successful in removing the sufferings by solving her neurotic conflict. What was he really reporting? If one interprets penis envy as other Freudian concepts have been reinterpreted in the light of our new knowledge that what Freud believed to be biological was often a cultural reaction, one sees simply that Victorian culture gave women many reasons to envy men. The same conditions, in fact, that the feminists fought against. If a woman who was denied the freedom, the status, and the pleasures that men enjoyed wished secretly that she could have these things, in the shorthand of the dream, she might wish herself a man and see herself with that one thing which made men unequivocally different, the penis. She would, of course, have to learn to keep her envy, her anger, hidden, to play the child, the doll, the toy, for her destiny depended on charming man. But underneath, it might still fester, sickening her for love. If she secretly despised herself and envied man for all she was not, she might go through the motions of love, or even feel a slavish adoration, but would she be capable of free and joyous love? You cannot explain away woman's envy of man, or her contempt for herself, as mere refusal to accept her sexual deformity, unless you think that a woman, by nature, is a being inferior to man. Then, of course, her wish to be equal is neurotic. It is recognized now that Freud never gave proper attention, even in man, to growth of the ego or self. The impulse to master, control, or come to self-fulfilling terms with the environment. Analysts who have freed themselves from Freud's bias and joined other behavioral scientists in studying the human need to grow are beginning to believe that this is the basic human need and that interference with it in any dimension is a source of psychic trouble. The sexual is only one dimension of the human potential. Freud, it must be remembered, thought all neuroses were sexual in origin. He saw women only in terms of their sexual relationship with men. But in all those women in whom he saw sexual problems, there must have been very severe problems of blocked growth, growth short of full human identity, an immature, incomplete self. Society, as it was then, by explicit denial of education and independence, prevented women from realizing their full potential or from attaining those interests and ideals that might have stimulated their growth. Freud reported these deficiencies but could only explain them as the toll of penis envy. He saw women's envy of man only as sexual sickness. He saw that women who secretly hungered to be man's equal would not enjoy being his object, and in this he seemed to be describing a fact. But when he dismissed woman's yearning for equality as penis envy, was he not merely stating his own view that women could never really be man's equal any more than she could wear his penis? Freud was not concerned with changing society, but in helping man and woman adjust to it. Thus he tells of a case of a middle-aged spinster whom he succeeded in freeing from a symptom complex that prevented her from taking any part in life for 15 years. Freed of these symptoms, she plunged into a whirl of activity in order to develop her talents, which were by no means small, and derive a little appreciation, enjoyment, and success from life before it was too late. But all her attempts ended when she saw that there was no place for her. Since she could no longer relapse into her neurotic symptoms, she began to have accidents. She sprained her ankle, her foot, her hand. When this also was analyzed, instead of accidents, she contracted on the same occasions slight illnesses such as catarrh, sore throat, influenzal conditions, or rheumatic swellings, until at last, when she made up her mind to resign herself to inactivity, the whole business came to an end. Even if Freud and his contemporaries considered women inferior by God-given, irrevocable nature, science does not justify such a view today. That inferiority, we now know, was caused by their lack of education, their confinement to the home. Today, when women's equal intelligence has been proved by science, when their equal capacity in every sphere except sheer muscular strength has been demonstrated, a theory explicitly based on woman's natural inferiority would seem as ridiculous as it is hypocritical. But that remains the basis of Freud's theory of women, despite the mask of timeless sexual truth which disguises its elaborations today. Because Freud's followers could only see woman in the image defined by Freud, inferior, childish, helpless, with no possibility of happiness unless she adjusted to being man's passive object, they wanted to help women get rid of their suppressed envy, their neurotic desire to be equal. They wanted to help women find sexual fulfillment as women by affirming their natural inferiority. But society, which defined that inferiority, had changed drastically by the time Freud's followers transposed bodily to 20th century America the causes as well as the cures of the condition Freud called penis envy. In the light of our new knowledge of cultural processes and of human growth, one would assume that women who grew up with the rights and freedom and education that Victorian women were denied would be different from the women Freud tried to cure. One would assume that they would have much less reason to envy man. But Freud was interpreted to American women in such curiously literal terms that the concept of penis envy acquired a mystical life of its own, as if it existed quite independent of the women in whom it had been observed. It was as if Freud's Victorian image of woman became more real than the 20th century women to whom it was applied. Freud's theory of femininity was seized in America with such literalness that women today were considered no different than Victorian women. The real injustices life held for women a century ago, compared to men, were dismissed as mere rationalizations of penis envy, and the real opportunities life offered to women now, compared to women then, were forbidden in the name of penis envy. The literal application of Freudian theory can be seen in these passages from Modern Woman, The Lost Sex, by the psychoanalyst Marinia Farnham and the sociologist Ferdinand Lundberg, which was paraphrased ad nauseam in the magazines and in marriage courses until most of its statements became part of the conventional, accepted truth of our time. Equating feminism with penis envy, they stated categorically, "Feminism, despite the external validity of its political program and most, not all, of its social program, was at its core a deep illness. The dominant direction of feminine training and development today discourages just those traits necessary to the attainment of sexual pleasure. Receptivity and passiveness, a willingness to accept dependence without fear or resentment, with a deep inwardness and readiness for the final goal of sexual life, impregnation. It is not in the capacity of the female organism to attain feelings of well-being by the route of male achievement. It was the error of the feminist that they attempted to put women on the essentially male road of exploit, off the female road of nurture. The psychosocial rule that begins to take form then is this. The more educated the woman is, the greater chance there is of sexual disorder, more or less severe. The greater the disordered sexuality in a given group of women, the fewer children do they have. Fate has granted them the boon importuned by Lady Macbeth. They have been unsexed, not only in the matter of giving birth, but in their feelings of pleasure." Thus Freud's popularizers embedded his core of unrecognized traditional prejudice against women ever deeper in pseudoscientific cement. Freud was well aware of his own tendency to build an enormous body of deductions from a single fact, a fertile and creative method, but a two-edged sword if the significance of that single fact was misinterpreted. Freud wrote Jung in 1909, "Your surmise that after my departure my errors might be adored as holy relics amused me enormously, But I don't believe it. On the contrary, I think that my followers will hasten to demolish, as swiftly as possible, everything that is not safe and sound in what I leave behind. But on the subject of women, Freud's followers not only compounded his errors, but in their tortuous attempt to fit their observations of real women into his theoretical framework, closed questions that he himself had left open. Thus, for instance, Helene Deutsch, whose definitive two-volume, The Psychology of Woman, A Psychoanalytical Interpretation, appeared in 1944, is not able to trace all women's troubles to penis envy as such. So she does what even Freud found unwise, and equates femininity with passivity, and masculinity with activity, not only in the sexual sphere, but in all spheres of life. While recognizing that woman's position is subjected to external influence, I venture to say that the fundamental identities, feminine passive and masculine active, assert themselves in all known cultures and races in various forms and various quantitative proportions. Very often, a woman resists this characteristic given her by nature, and in spite of certain advantages she derives from it, displays many modes of behavior that suggest that she is not entirely content with her own constitution. The expression of this dissatisfaction, combined with attempts to remedy it, result in woman's masculinity complex. The masculinity complex, as Dr. Deutsch refines it, stems directly from the female castration complex. Thus, anatomy is still destiny. Woman is still an homme manqué. Of course, Dr. Deutsch mentions in passing that, with regard to the girl, however, the environment exerts an inhibiting influence as regards both her aggressions and her activity. So, penis envy, deficient female anatomy, and society all seem to work together to produce femininity. Normal femininity is achieved, however, only insofar as the woman finally renounces all active goals of her own, all her own originality, to identify and fulfill herself through the activities and goals of husband or son. This process can be sublimated in non-sexual ways, as, for instance, the woman who does the basic research for her male superior's discoveries. The daughter who devotes her life to her father is also making a satisfactory feminine sublimation. Only activity of her own, or originality, on a basis of equality, deserves the opprobrium of masculinity complex. This brilliant feminine follower of Freud states categorically that the women who, by 1944 in America, had achieved eminence by activity of their own in various fields, had done so at the expense of their feminine fulfillment. She will mention no names, but they all suffer from the masculinity complex. How could a girl or woman who was not a psychoanalyst discount such ominous pronouncements which, in the 40s, suddenly began to pour out from all the oracles of sophisticated thought? It would be ridiculous to suggest that the way Freudian theories were used to brainwash two generations of educated American women was part of a psychoanalytic conspiracy. It was done by well-meaning popularizers and inadvertent distorters, by orthodox converts and bandwagon faddists, by those who suffered and those who cured and those who turned suffering to profit, and, above all, by a congruence of forces and needs peculiar to the American people at that particular time. In fact, the literal acceptance in the American culture of Freud's theory of feminine fulfillment was in tragicomic contrast to the personal struggle of many American psychoanalysts to reconcile what they saw in their women patients with Freudian theory. The theory said women should be able to fulfill themselves as wives and mothers if only they could be analyzed out of their masculine strivings, their penis envy. But it wasn't as easy as that. I don't know why American women are so dissatisfied, a Westchester analyst insisted. Penis envy seems so difficult to eradicate in American women somehow. A New York analyst, one of the last trained at Freud's own psychoanalytic institute in Vienna, told me, "For 20 years now, in analyzing American women, I have found myself again and again in the position of having to superimpose Freud's theory of femininity on the psychic life of my patients in a way that I was not willing to do. I have come to the conclusion that penis envy simply does not exist. I have seen women who are completely expressive, sexually, vaginally, and yet who are not mature, integrated, fulfilled. I had a woman patient on the couch for nearly 2 years before I could face a real problem, that it was not enough for her to be just a housewife and mother. One day she had a dream that she was teaching a class. I could not dismiss the powerful yearning of this housewife's dream as penis envy. It was the expression of her own need for mature self-fulfillment. I told her, I can't analyze this dream away. You must do something about it. The same man teaches the young analyst in his postgraduate clinicum at a leading Eastern university. If the patient doesn't fit the book, throw away the book and listen to the patient. But many analysts threw the book at their patients, and Freudian theories became accepted fact even among women who never lay down on an analyst's couch, but only knew what they read or heard. To this day, it has not penetrated to the popular culture that the pervasive growing frustration of American women may not be a matter of feminine sexuality. Some analysts, it is true, modified the theories drastically to fit their patients or even discarded them altogether, but these facts never permeated the public awareness. Freud was accepted so quickly and completely at the end of the 40s that for over a decade, no one even questioned the race of the educated American woman back to the home. When questions finally had to be asked because something was obviously going wrong, they were asked so completely within the Freudian framework that only one answer was possible: education, freedom, rights, or wrong for women. The uncritical acceptance of Freudian doctrine in America was caused, at least in part, by the very relief it provided from uncomfortable questions about objective realities. After the Depression, after the war, Freudian psychology became much more than a science of human behavior, a therapy for the suffering. It became an all-embracing American ideology, a new religion. It filled the vacuum of thought and purpose that existed for many from whom God or flag or bank account were no longer sufficient, and yet who were tired of feeling responsible for lynchings and concentration camps and the starving children of India and Africa. It provided a convenient escape from the atom bomb, McCarthy, all the disconcerting problems that might spoil the taste of steaks and cars and color television and backyard swimming pools. It gave us permission to suppress the troubling questions of the larger world and pursue our own personal pleasures. And if the new psychological religion, which made a virtue of sex, removed all sin from private vice and cast suspicion on high aspirations of the mind and spirit, had a more devastating personal effect on women than men, nobody planned it that way. Psychology, long preoccupied with its own scientific inferiority complex, long obsessed with neat little laboratory experiments that gave the illusion of reducing human complexity to the simple measurable behavior of rats in a maze, was transformed into a life-giving crusade that swept across the barren fields of American thought. Freud was a spiritual leader. His theories were the Bible. And how exciting and real and important it all was. Its mysterious complexity was part of its charm to bored Americans. And if some of it remained impenetrably mystifying, who would admit that he could not understand it? America became the center of the psychoanalytic movement as Freudian, Jungian, Adlerian analysts fled from Vienna and Berlin, and new schools flourished on the multiplying neuroses and dollars of Americans. But the practice of psychoanalysis as a therapy was not primarily responsible for the feminine mystique. It was the creation of writers and editors in the mass media, ad agency motivation researchers, and behind them the popularizers and translators of Freudian thought in the colleges and universities. Freudian and pseudo-Freudian theories settled everywhere like fine volcanic ash. Sociology, anthropology, education, even the study of history and literature became permeated and transfigured by Freudian thought. The most zealous missionaries of the feminine mystique were the functionalists, who seized hasty gulps of pre-digested Freud to start their new departments of marriage and family life education. The functional courses in marriage taught American college girls how to play the role of woman. The old role became a new science. Related movements outside the colleges, parent education, child study groups, prenatal maternity study groups, and mental health education spread the new psychological superego throughout the land, replacing bridge and canasta as an entertainment for educated young wives. And this Freudian superego worked for growing numbers of young and impressionable American women, as Freud said the superego works, to perpetuate the past. Mankind never lives completely in the present. The ideologies of the superego perpetuate the past, the traditions of the race and the people, which yield but slowly to the influence of the present and to new developments, and, so long as they work through the superego, play an important part in man's life, quite independently of economic conditions. The feminine mystique, elevated by Freudian theory into a scientific religion, sounded a single, overprotective, life-restricting, future-denying note for women. Girls who grew up playing baseball, babysitting, mastering geometry, almost independent enough, almost resourceful enough to meet the problems of the fission-fusion era, were told by the most advanced thinkers of our time to go back and live their lives as if they were Noras, restricted to the doll's house by Victorian prejudice. And their own respect and awe for the authority of science, anthropology, sociology, psychology share that authority now, kept them from questioning the feminine mystique. Chapter 6, The Functional Freeze, The Feminine Protest, and Margaret Mead. Instead of destroying the old prejudices that restricted women's lives, social science in America merely gave them new authority. By a curious circular process, the insights of psychology and anthropology and sociology, which should have been powerful weapons to free women, somehow canceled each other out, trapping women in dead center. During the last 20 years, under the catalytic impact of Freudian thought, psychoanalysts, anthropologists, sociologists, social psychologists, and other workers in the behavioral sciences have met in professional seminars and foundation finance conferences in many university centers. Cross-fertilization seemed to make them all bloom, but some strange hybrids were produced. A psychoanalyst began to reinterpret Freudian concepts like oral and anal personality in the light of an awareness borrowed from anthropology that cultural processes must have been at work in Freud's Vienna. Anthropologists set out for the South Sea Islands to chart tribal personality according to literal oral and anal tables. Armed with psychological hints for ethnological field workers, the anthropologists often found what they were looking for. Instead of translating, sifting the cultural bias out of Freudian theories, Margaret Mead and the others who pioneered in the fields of culture and personality compounded the error by fitting their own anthropological observations into Freudian rubric. But none of this might have had the same freezing effect on women if it had not been for a simultaneous aberration of American social scientists called functionalism. Centering primarily on cultural anthropology and sociology, and reaching its extremes in the applied field of family life education, functionalism began as an attempt to make social science more scientific by borrowing from biology the idea of studying institutions as if they were muscles or bones in terms of their structure and function in the social body. By studying an institution only in terms of its function within its own society, the social scientists intended to avert unscientific value judgments. In practice, functionalism was less a scientific movement than a scientific word game. The function is was often translated, the function should be. The social scientists did not recognize their own prejudices in functional disguise any more than the analysts recognized theirs in Freudian disguise. By giving an absolute meaning and a sanctimonious value to the generic term woman's role, functionalism put American women into a kind of deep freeze, like sleeping beauties waiting for a Prince Charming to waken them, while all around the magic circle the world moved on. The social scientists, male and female, who in the name of functionalism drew this torturously tight circle around American women, also seemed to share a certain attitude, which I will call the feminine protest. If there is such a thing as a masculine protest, the psychoanalytic concept taken over by the functionalists to describe women who envied men and wanted to be men and therefore denied that they were women and became more manly than any man, its counterpart can be seen today in a feminine protest made by men and women alike who deny what women really are and make more of being a woman than it could ever be. The feminine protest, at its most straightforward, is simply a means of protecting women from the dangers inherent in assuming true equality with men. But why should any social scientist with godlike manipulative superiority take it upon himself or herself to protect women from the pains of growing up? Protectiveness has often muffled the sound of doors closing against women. It has often cloaked a very real prejudice, even when it is offered in the name of science. If an old-fashioned grandfather frowned at Nora, who was studying calculus because she wants to be a physicist, and muttered, "Woman's place is in the home," Nora would laugh impatiently, "Grandpa, this is 1963. But she does not laugh at the urbane pipe-smoking professor of sociology, or the book by Margaret Mead, or the definitive two-volume reference on female sexuality when they tell her the same thing. The complex, mysterious language of functionalism, Freudian psychology, and cultural anthropology hides from her the fact that they say this with not much more basis than Grandpa. So our Nora would smile at Queen Victoria's letter written in 1870. The Queen is most anxious to enlist everyone who can speak or write to join in checking this mad, wicked folly of woman's rights with all its attendant horrors on which her poor, feeble sex is bent, forgetting every sense of womanly feeling and propriety. It is a subject which makes the Queen so furious that she cannot contain herself. God created men and women different. Then let them remain each in their own position. But she does not smile when she reads in Marriage for Moderns. The sexes are complementary. It is the works of my watch that move the hands and enable me to tell time. Are the works, therefore, more important than the case? Neither is superior, neither inferior. Each must be judged in terms of its own functions. Together, they form a functioning unit. So it is with men and women. Together, they form a functioning unit. Either alone is, in a sense, incomplete. They are complementary. When men and women engage in the same occupations or perform common functions, the complementary relationship may break down. This book was published in 1942. Girls have studied it as a college text for the past 20 years. Under the guise of sociology or marriage and family life or life adjustment, they are offered advice of this sort. The fact remains, however, that we live in a world of reality, a world of the present and the immediate future, on which there rests the heavy hand of the past, a world in which tradition still holds sway and the mores exert a stronger influence than does the theorist. A world in which most men and women do marry and in which most married women are homemakers. To talk about what might be done if tradition and the mores were radically changed or what may come about by the year 2000 may be interesting mental gymnastics, but it does not help the young people of today to adjust to the inevitables of life or raise their marriages to a higher plane of satisfaction. Of course, this adjustment to the inevitables of life denies the speed with which the conditions of life are now changing, and the fact that many girls who so adjust at 20 will still be alive in the year 2000. This functionalist specifically warns against any and all approaches to the differences between men and women, except adjustment to those differences as they now stand. And if, like our Nora, a woman is contemplating a career, he shakes a warning finger. For the first time in history, American young women, in great numbers, are being faced with these questions. Shall I voluntarily prepare myself for a lifelong celibate career? Or shall I prepare for a temporary vocation, which I shall give up when I marry and assume the responsibilities of homemaking and motherhood? Or should I attempt to combine homemaking and a career? The great majority of married women are homemakers. If a woman can find adequate self-expression through a career rather than through marriage, well and good. Many young women, however, overlook the fact that there are numerous careers that do not furnish any medium or offer any opportunity for self-expression. Besides, they do not realize that only the minority of women, as the minority of men, have anything particularly worthwhile to express. And so Nora is left with the cheerful impression that if she chooses a career, she is also choosing celibacy. If she has any illusions about combining marriage and career, the functionalist admonishes her. How many individuals can successfully pursue two careers simultaneously? Not many. The exceptional person can do it, but the ordinary person cannot. The problem of combining marriage and homemaking with another career is especially difficult, since it is likely that the two pursuits will demand qualities of different types. The former, to be successful, requires self-negation, the latter, self-enhancement. The former demands cooperation, the latter, competition. There is greater opportunity for happiness if husband and wife supplement each other than there is when there is duplication of function. And just in case Nora has any doubts about giving up her career ambitions, she is offered this comforting rationalization. A woman who is an effective homemaker must know something about teaching, interior decoration, cooking, dietetics, consumption, psychology, physiology, social relations, community resources, clothing, household equipment, housing, hygiene, and a host of other things. She is a general practitioner rather than a specialist. The young woman who decides upon homemaking as her career need have no feeling of inferiority. One may say, as some do, men can have careers because women make homes. One may say that women are released from the necessity for wage earning and are free to devote their time to the extremely important matter of homemaking because men specialize in breadwinning. Or one may say that together the breadwinner and the homemaker form a complementary combination second to none. This marriage textbook is not the most subtle of its school. It is almost too easy to see that its functional argument is based on no real chain of scientific fact. It is hardly scientific to say, this is what is, therefore this is what should be. But this is the essence of functionalism as it came to pervade all of American sociology in this period, whether or not the sociologist called himself a functionalist. In colleges, which would never stoop to the role-playing lessons of the so-called functional family course, young women were assigned Talcott Parsons' authoritative Analysis of Sex Roles in the Social Structure of the United States, which contemplates no alternative for a woman other than the role of housewife, patterned with varying emphasis on domesticity, glamour, and good companionship. It is perhaps not too much to say that only in very exceptional cases can an adult man be genuinely self-respecting and enjoy a respected status in the eyes of others if he does not earn a living in an improved occupational role. In the case of the feminine role, the situation is radically different. The woman's fundamental status is that of her husband's wife, the mother of his children. Parsons, a highly respected sociologist and the leading functional theoretician, describes with insight and accuracy the sources of strain in this segregation of sex roles. He points out that the domestic aspect of the housewife role has declined in importance to the point where it scarcely approaches a full-time occupation for a vigorous person, that the glamour pattern is inevitably associated with a rather early age level, and thus serious strains result from the problem of adaptation to increasing age, that the good companion pattern, which includes humanistic cultivation of the arts and community welfare, suffers from a lack of fully institutionalized status. It is only those with the strongest initiative and intelligence who achieve fully satisfying adaptations in this direction. He states that it is quite clear that in the adult feminine role, there is quite sufficient strain and insecurity so that widespread manifestations are to be expected in the form of neurotic behavior. But Parsons warns, it is, of course, possible for the adult woman to follow the masculine pattern and seek a career in fields of occupational achievement in direct competition with men of her own class. It is, however, notable that in spite of the very great progress of the emancipation of women from the traditional domestic pattern, only a very small fraction have gone very far in this direction. It is also clear that its generalization would only be possible with profound alterations in the structure of the family. True equality between men and women would not be functional. The status quo can be maintained only if the wife and mother is exclusively a homemaker or, at most, has a job rather than a career, which might give her status equal to that of her husband. Thus Parsons finds sexual segregation functional in terms of keeping the social structure as it is, which seems to be the functionalist's primary concern. Absolute equality of opportunity is clearly incompatible with any positive solidarity of the family. Where married women are employed outside the home, it is, for the great majority, in occupations which are not in direct competition for status with those of men of their own class. Women's interests and the standard of judgment applied to them run, in our society, far more in the direction of personal adornment. It is suggested that this difference is functionally related to maintaining family solidarity in our class structure. Even the eminent woman sociologist Mira Komorowski, whose functional analysis of how girls learn to play the role of woman in our society is brilliant indeed, cannot quite escape the rigid mold functionalism imposes, adjustment to the status quo. For to limit one's field of inquiry to the function of an institution in a given social system, with no alternatives considered, provides an infinite number of rationalizations for all the inequalities and inequities of that system. It is not surprising that social scientists began to mistake their own function as one of helping the individual adjust to his role in that system. A social order can function only because the vast majority have somehow adjusted themselves to their place in society and performed the functions expected of them. The differences in the upbringing of the sexes are obviously related to their respective roles in adult life. The future homemaker trains for her role within the home, but the boy prepares for his by being given more independence outside the home by his taking a paper route or a summer job. A provider will profit by independence, dominance, aggressiveness, competitiveness. The risk of the traditional upbringing of girls, as a sociologist sees it, is its possible failure to develop in the girl the independence, inner resources, and that degree of self-assertion which life will demand of her in her role as wife. The functional warning follows. Even if a parent correctly considers certain conventional attributes of the feminine role to be worthless, he creates risks for the girl in forcing her to stray too far from the accepted mores of her time. The steps which parents must take to prepare their daughters to meet economic exigencies and familial responsibilities of modern life, these very steps may awaken aspirations and develop habits which conflict with certain features of their feminine roles as these are defined today. The very education which is to make the college housewife a cultural leaven of her family and her community may develop in her interests which are frustrated by other phases of housewifery. We run the risk of awakening interests and abilities which, again, run counter to the present definition of femininity. She goes on to cite the recent case of a girl who wanted to be a sociologist. She was engaged to a GI who didn't want his wife to work. The girl herself hoped she wouldn't find a good job in sociology. An unsatisfactory job would, she felt, make it easier for her to comply eventually with her future husband's wishes. The needs of the country for trained workers, the uncertainty of her own future, her current interests notwithstanding, she took a routine job. Only the future will tell whether her decision was prudent. If her fiancé returns from the front, if the marriage takes place, if he's able to provide for the family without her assistance, if her frustrated wishes do not boomerang, then she will not regret her decision. At the present historical moment, the best-adjusted girl is probably one who is intelligent enough to do well in school, but not so brilliant as to get all A's, capable, but not in areas relatively new to women, able to stand on her own 2 feet and to earn a living, but not so good a living as to compete with men, capable of doing some job well in case she doesn't marry or otherwise has to work, but not so identified with the profession as to need it for her happiness. So, in the name of adjustment to the cultural definition of femininity, in which this brilliant sociologist obviously does not herself believe that word correctly betrays her, she ends up virtually endorsing the continued infantilizing of American woman, except insofar as it has the unintended consequence of making the transition from the role of daughter to that of the spouse more difficult for her than for the son. Essentially, it is assumed that to the extent that the woman remains more infantile, less able to make her own decisions, more dependent upon one or both parents for initiating and channeling behavior and attitudes, more closely attached to them so as to find it difficult to part from them or to face their disapproval, or shows any other indices of lack of emotional emancipation, to that extent she may find it more difficult than the man to conform to the cultural norm of primary loyalty to the family she establishes later. It is possible, of course, that the only effect of the greater sheltering is to create in women a generalized dependency which will then be transferred to the husband and which will enable her all the more readily to accept the role of wife in a family which still has many patriarchal features. She finds evidence in a number of studies that college girls, in fact, are more infantile, dependent, and tied to parents than boys, and do not mature as boys do by learning to stand alone. But she can find no evidence in 20 psychiatric texts that there are, accordingly, more in-law problems with the wife's parents than the husband's. Evidently, only with such evidence could a functionalist comfortably question the deliberate infantilization of American girls. Functionalism was an easy out for American sociologists. There can be no doubt that they were describing things as they were, but in so doing, they were relieved of the responsibility of building theory from facts, of probing for deeper truth. They were also relieved of the need to formulate questions and answers that would be inevitably controversial at a time in academic circles, as in America as a whole, when controversy was not welcome. They assumed an endless present and based their reasoning on denying the possibility of a future different from the past. Of course, their reason would hold up only as long as the future did not change. As C.P. Snow has pointed out, science and scientists are future-minded. Social scientists under the functional banner were so rigidly present-minded that they denied the future. Their theories enforced the prejudices of the past and actually prevented change. Sociologists themselves have recently come to the conclusion that functionalism was rather embarrassing because it really said nothing at all. As Kingsley Davis pointed out in his presidential address on the myth of functional analysis as a special method in sociology and anthropology at the American Sociological Association in 1959. For more than 30 years now, functional analysis has been debated among sociologists and anthropologists. However strategic it may have been in the past, it has now become an impediment rather than a prop to scientific progress. The claim that functionalism cannot handle social change because it posits an integrated, static society is true by definition. Unfortunately, the female objects of functional analysis were profoundly affected by it. At a time of great change for women, at a time when education, science, and social science should have helped women bridge the change, functionalism transformed what is for women, or what was, to what should be. Those who perpetrated the feminine protest and made more of being a woman than it can ever be, in the name of functionalism or for whatever complex of personal or intellectual reasons, closed the door of the future on women. In all the concern for adjustment, one truth was forgotten. Women were being adjusted to a state inferior to their full capabilities. The functionalists did not wholly accept the Freudian argument that anatomy is destiny, but they accepted wholeheartedly an equally restrictive definition of woman. Woman is what society says she is. And most of the functional anthropologists studied societies in which woman's destiny was defined by anatomy. The most powerful influence on modern women in terms both of functionalism and the feminine protest was Margaret Mead. Her work on culture and personality, book after book, study after study, has had a profound effect on the women in my generation, the one before it, and the generation now growing up. She was, and still is, the symbol of the woman thinker in America. She has written millions of words in the 30-odd years between coming of age in Samoa in 1928 and her latest article on American women in the New York Times Magazine, or Red Book. She has studied in college classrooms by girls taking courses in anthropology, sociology, psychology, education, and marriage and family life. In graduate schools by those who will one day teach girls and counsel women, in medical schools by future pediatricians and psychiatrists, even in theological schools by progressive young ministers. And she is read in the women's magazines and the Sunday supplements, where she publishes as readily as in the learned journals by girls and women of all ages. Margaret Mead is her own best popularizer, and her influence has been felt in almost every layer of American thought. But her influence for women has been a paradox. A mystique takes what it needs from any thinker of the time. The feminine mystique might have taken from Margaret Mead her vision of the infinite variety of sexual patterns and the enormous plasticity of human nature, a vision based on the differences of sex and temperament she found in three primitive societies, the Arapesh, where both men and women were feminine and maternal in personality and passively sexual, because both were trained to be cooperative, unaggressive, responsive to the needs and demands of others, the Mundugamore, where both husband and wife were violent, aggressive, positively sexed, masculine. And the Chambuli, where the woman was the dominant and personal managing partner, and the man the less responsible and emotionally dependent person. If those temperamental attitudes, which we have traditionally regarded as feminine, such as passivity, responsiveness, and a willingness to cherish children, can so easily be set up as the masculine pattern in one tribe and in another be outlawed for the majority of women as well as for the majority of men, we no longer have any basis for regarding such aspects of behavior as sex-linked. The material suggests that we may say that many, if not all, of the personality traits which we have called masculine or feminine, are as lightly linked to sex as are the clothing, the manners, and the form of headdress that a society at a given period assigns to either sex. From such anthropological observations, she might have passed on to the popular culture a truly revolutionary vision of women finally free to realize their full capabilities in a society which replaced arbitrary sexual definitions with the recognition of genuine individual gifts as they occur in either sex. She had such a vision more than once. Where writing is accepted as a profession that may be pursued by either sex with perfect suitability, individuals who have the ability to write need not be debarred by it from their sex, nor need they, if they do write, doubt their essential masculinity or femininity. And it is here that we can find a ground plan for building a society that would substitute real differences for arbitrary ones. We must recognize that beneath the superficial classifications of sex and race, the same potentialities exist, recurring generation after generation, only to perish because society has no place for them. Just as society now permits the practice of an art to members of either sex, so it might also permit the development of many contrasting temperamental gifts in each sex. It would abandon its various attempts to make boys fight and to make girls remain passive, or to make all children fight. No child would be relentlessly shaped to one pattern of behavior, but instead there should be many patterns. In a world that had learned to allow to each individual the pattern which was most congenial to his gifts. But this is not the vision the mystique took from Margaret Mead, nor is it the vision that she continues to offer. Increasingly, in her own pages, her interpretation blurs, is subtly transformed into a glorification of women in the female role, as defined by their sexual biological function. At times, she seems to lose her own anthropological awareness of the malleability of human personality and to look at anthropological data from the Freudian point of view. Sexual biology determines all. Anatomy is destiny. At times, she seems to be arguing in functional terms that while woman's potential is as great and various as the unlimited human potential, it is better to preserve the sexual biological limitations established by culture. At times she says both things in the same page, and even sounds a note of caution, warning of the dangers a woman faces in trying to realize a human potential which her society has defined as masculine. The difference between the two sexes is one of the most important conditions upon which we have built the many varieties of human culture that give human beings dignity and stature. Sometimes one quality has been assigned to one sex, sometimes to the other. Now it is boys who are thought of as infinitely vulnerable and in need of special cherishing care. Now it is girls. Some people think of women as too weak to work out of doors. Others regard women as the appropriate bearers of heavy burdens because their heads are stronger than men's. Some religions, including our Eastern traditional religions, have assigned women an inferior role in the religious hierarchy. Others have built their whole symbolic relationship with the supernatural world upon male imitations of the natural functions of women. Whether we deal with small matters or with large, with the frivolities of ornament and cosmetics or the sanctities of man's place in the universe, we find this great variety of ways, often flatly contradictory one to the other, in which the roles of the two sexes have been patterned. But we always find the patterning. We know of no culture that has said articulately that there is no difference between men and women except in the way they contribute to the creation of the next generation, that otherwise in all respects they are simply human beings with varying gifts, no one of which can be exclusively assigned to either sex. Are we dealing with a must that we dare not flout because it is rooted so deep in our biological mammalian nature that to flout it means individual and social disease? Or with a must that, although not so deeply rooted, still is so very socially convenient and so well tried that it would be uneconomical to flout it. A must which says, for example, that it is easier to get children born and bred if we stylize the behavior of the sexes very differently, teaching them to walk and dress and act in contrasting ways and to specialize in different kinds of work. We must also ask, what are the potentialities of sex differences? If little boys have to meet and assimilate the early shock of knowing that they can never create a baby with the sureness and incontrovertibility that is a woman's birthright, how does this make them more creatively ambitious as well as more dependent upon achievement? If little girls have a rhythm of growth, which means that their own sex appears to them as initially less sure than their brothers, and so gives them a little false flick towards compensatory achievement that almost always dies down before the certainty of maternity. This probably does mean a limitation on their sense of ambition, but what positive potentialities are there also? In these passages from Male and Female, a book which became the cornerstone of the feminine mystique, Margaret Mead betrays her Freudian orientation, even though she cautiously prefaces each statement of apparent scientific fact with the small word, if. But it is a very significant if. For when sexual differences become the basis of your approach to culture and personality, and when you assume that sexuality is the driving force of human personality, an assumption that you took from Freud, and when, moreover, as an anthropologist, you know that there are no true for every culture sexual differences except those involved in the act of procreation, you will inevitably give that one biological difference, the difference in reproductive role, increasing importance in the determination of woman's personality. Margaret Mead did not conceal the fact that, after 1931, Freudian rubrics, based on the zones of the body, were part of the equipment she took with her on anthropological field trips. Thus, she began to equate those assertive, creative, productive aspects of life on which the superstructure of a civilization depends, with the penis, and to define feminine creativity in terms of the passive receptivity of the uterus. In discussing men and women, I should be concerned with the primary differences between them, the difference in their reproductive roles. Out of the body's fashion for complementary roles in perpetuating the race, what differences in functioning, in capacities, in sensitivities, and vulnerabilities arise? How is it what men can do related to the fact that their reproductive role is over in a single act? What women can do related to the fact that their reproductive role takes 9 months of gestation, and until recently, many months of breastfeeding? What is the contribution of each sex, seen as itself, not as a mere imperfect version of the other? Living in the modern world, clothed and muffled, forced to convey our sense of our bodies in terms of remote symbols like walking sticks and umbrellas and handbags, it is easy to lose sight of the immediacy of the human body plan. But when one lives among primitive peoples, where women wear only a pair of little grass aprons, and may discard even these to insult each other or to bathe in a group, and men wear only a very lightly fastened G-string of beaten bark, and small babies wear nothing at all, the basic communications that are conducted between bodies become very real. In our own society, we have now invented a therapeutic method that can laboriously deduce from the recollections of the neurotic or the untrammeled fantasies of the psychotic how the human body, its entrances and exits, originally shaped the growing individual's view of the world. As a matter of fact, the lens of anatomy is destiny seemed to be peculiarly right for viewing the cultures and personalities of Samoa, Manus, Arapesh, Mungudamur, Jambuli, Ayet, Mul, and Bali, right as perhaps it never was right in that formulation for Vienna at the end of the 19th century, or America in the 20th. In the primitive civilizations of the South Sea Islands, anatomy was still destiny when Margaret Mead first visited them. Freud's theory that the primitive instincts of the body determined adult personality could find convincing demonstration. The complex goals of more advanced civilizations in which instinct and environment are increasingly controlled and transformed by the human mind did not then form the irreversible matrix of every human life. It must have been much easier to see biological differences between men and women as the basic force in life in those unclothed primitive peoples. But only if you go to such an island with the Freudian lens in your eye, accepting before you start what certain irreverent anthropologists call the toilet paper theory of history, will you draw from observations in primitive civilizations of the role of the unclothed body, male or female, a lesson for modern women which assumes that the unclothed body can determine in the same way the course of human life and personality in a complex modern civilization. Anthropologists today are less inclined to see in primitive civilization a laboratory for the observation of our own civilization, a scale model with all the irrelevancies blotted out. Civilization is just not that irrelevant. Because the human body is the same in primitive South Sea tribes as modern cities, an anthropologist who starts with the physiological theory that reduces human personality and civilization to bodily analogies can end up advising modern women to live through their bodies in the same way as the women of the South Seas. The trouble is that Margaret Mead could not recreate a South Sea world for us to live in, a world where having a baby is the pinnacle of human achievement. If reproduction were the chief and only fact of human life, would all men today suffer from uterus envy? In Bali, little girls between 2 and 3 walk much of the time with purposely thrust out little bellies, and the older women tap them playfully as they pass. Pregnant, they tease. So the little girl learns that although the signs of her membership in her own sex are slight, her breasts, mere tiny buttons no bigger than her brother's, her genitals, a simple, inconspicuous